Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 81 of Season 7 of Movie Real Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today, and hopefully all week, is Todd Liebenow of the Forgotten Filmcast. Welcome back to the show, Todd.
Thank you, Rob. Always great to be here.
Yeah, it's always fun having you on these shows. You know, I like the way that you look at these things. You
know, well, that's good.
Of course. Let's start off with this. With the first question, do you remember the first time that you saw Die Hard with a Vengeance?
I do. This is actually one I can remember when and where I saw it in the theater. I'm pretty sure I saw it opening weekend, and I went and saw it at what back then was called the Continental Theater here in Denver. I'd only been living in Denver for about a year, and the Continental was a big, like, 1,000-seat theater. So it was where you got to see things on a big, big screen. And I remember going to see Independence Day. We went to see that there because we were like, we want to see that on the biggest screen. And I remember going to a few like retro showings of things there. I saw The Wizard of Oz there. I think I saw a screening of Star Trek III there. Sadly, it's not open anymore. And I keep hoping someone's going to, you know, kind of take hold of it and keep the big screen going, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. But used to be one of my favorite spots to go for movie viewing in Denver. If you wanted to see it on a big screen, the Continental was the place to go.
Very, very cool to hear that. And did you like it when you first saw it, or did you have to watch it a few times before you started really enjoying it?
Oh no, absolutely. I enjoyed it tremendously. I mean, I've got nothing against Die Hard 2. I like Die Hard 2 just fine, but Die Hard with a Vengeance seriously battles in my mind at times, you know, in terms of, do I like this one better or do I like the original? And my heart always has to go back to the original. I mean, the original is just something special, started its own kind of mini genre of movies. But Die Hard with a Vengeance, I mean, if there were no other Die Hard movies other than Die Hard and Die Hard with a Vengeance, I'd still be okay because I love both those films.
Okay, that's fair. I mean, I have the same issue, but it's with the first three. You know, the first one I didn't see in the theater. The first time I saw it at a friend's house where his parents didn't let us watch our rated movies, so we rented it. And every time his parents would walk past the room, we'd have to switch the channel. So like,
yeah.
I didn't get to see it, direct, you know, from start to finish the first time I watched it. And I do remember that summer it was on cable. So this was, I guess, the summer of 1989. And I was on a trip like out west, and, you know, we were staying in motels and it was on HBO. Mm-hmm. So like just about every night, me and all my friends would sit and watch Die Hard. Like I saw it so many times at that point. And then the second one is one of only two movies that I've seen twice in the theater back to back, meaning I saw it on a special. Just to let everyone a little bit behind the curtain, you know, right now it's Independence Day weekend. So Die Hard 2 came out on July 4th, and I saw a special screening on July 3rd at like 8 o'clock at night or something like that. I went with a friend of mine. And then I went with another friend of mine the following day for the first showing at noon.
Oh, wow. You know,
so that's like the only one of two movies that I've seen back to back, you know, in the theater within, you know, less than 24 hours. The other one is Jurassic Park when that came out, I guess three years later, because that was 1993.
Right.
No, I'm saying Die Hard 2 was 90. So 93, that was 3 years later. And then when Die Hard with a Vengeance came out, so it came out later in Israel than it did in America, if I remember correctly, because in America it came out Memorial Day weekend. And I remember when it came out, it was the night that I think Friends premiered here in Israel on cable. So I like had set my VCR to be able to tape it because we had heard that it was this great show. And then I was supposed to had like a class. I had a very crazy college experience where some of my classes were just me and the professor. And I was supposed to have a class with him. And I called him up and said I wasn't feeling well because I wanted to go see Die Hard with a Vengeance with friends. And so we went to like a 7 o'clock showing or something like that. And guess who I bumped into when I came out of the theater?
No idea.
The professor who was on his way to go see the show.
Oh, well, there you go. That's awesome.
Yeah. So you see that. So all three diehards are among my favorites. So I have a lot of trouble deciding which is my favorite because they all have different sentimental values to me, which I guess is one of the reasons why I've done all three now, because, you know, to me, they're all great movies. You know, it's just a question of, you know, any day I could stack them in different orders, depending on, you know, my feelings at the moment.
You brought up an interesting question here, and I don't know, maybe you've covered this already, I don't know, but you know, you saying that in the part of you, the world you were in, this came out a little bit later than it did in the US. What studio was it under in your part of the world? Because I always found it intriguing from the things that I've read that here in the States, of course, it's 20th Century Fox, but in some parts of the world, this could be considered a Disney movie because it was released through Touchstone Pictures, which was a branch of Disney. And of course, I'm aware of this because for years I did a podcast called Walt Sent Me that was about Disney movies. And we meant Disney in the grand scheme of things, you know, not just Walt Disney Pictures, but also Touchstone Pictures, Hollywood Pictures, Miramax for the time they owned Miramax, Dimension Films, Marvel, you know, all those different branches of Disney. So was this a Fox film or was this a Disney film where you were?
From what I remember, it was a Fox film. I do not believe that it was a Disney film at the time.
Now it's all Disney because Fox is under Disney.
Fine. Obviously. Yeah, so, no, but I'm right now actually looking on IMDb, which says, you know, like all the different countries. It doesn't say anything about it at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've only ever seen that mentioned, you know, in like Wikipedia articles and things like that. I've never actually seen, you know, a copy of Die Hard with a Vengeance that has the Touchstone logo or anything like that on there. So I've always just been going by what the internet says on that.
Right. I mean, what it says on IMDb is I see that it was Touchstone Home Video in certain countries. Mm. Okay. It mentions the Netherlands is mentioned twice. That it's and the United Kingdom. Those are the only ones that are listed under Touchstone Home Video.
Interesting. So okay.
I don't know that. And when I, you know, at the time, I don't think that they would have mentioned anything as Disney.
Oh, of course not. No.
Yeah. Oh, actually, here it says that the DVD was in the Netherlands once again. The Blu-ray of the DVD was Walt Disney Studios Home Entertainment. It was also in Sweden for that. Then it's VOD in the United Kingdom's Disney Plus, as well as Brazil. Yeah, those are the ones that they have there. we're talking 29 years ago. I do not remember, you know, what production company was on the screen when I was getting ready to see John McClane. So I can't really tell you with 100%, you know, for sure that it wasn't, you know, Touchstone, but I'm pretty sure it was 20th Century Fox.
Yeah.
You know,
most likely.
That would be my guess. You know, if I needed to bet money on it, that's what I would say. Mm-hmm. But thankfully I'm not betting any money on it because there's apparently no way of really checking until we get that time machine fixed. You know, once we figure out a way of getting 1.2 gigawatts, maybe we could figure it out, you know, of going back and watching it. You know, hey, maybe I should get in touch with my professor and see if he remembers.
Yeah, you know, there you
from
go.
When he saw it. Who knows? But yeah, so does that mean that when you would have talked about this on Walt Sent Me or not?
Probably not, because I kind of tended to go by what it was in the U.S. I don't know that we really ran into too many other examples where, you know, there might have been some crossover. I was a little flexible because I do remember we did an episode on Popeye, the Robert Altman film, which in the United States, of course, was released under Paramount Pictures, but overseas was released under Walt Disney Pictures. You can see both names in the credits, regardless of the version of the film that you watch. So, you know, if you're watching it in the U.S., it says Paramount Pictures Presents, and then something like in association with Walt Disney Productions, something like that. So we did do an episode on that one. So maybe, you know, we might have gotten around to Die Hard with a Vengeance. Who knows?
Right. Okay. That's fair. No, because I know that you're a movie snob when it comes to these things, you know. And I mean that in a loving way, you know. Like when with you dealing with forgotten films, like what's considered a forgotten film and stuff like that. So, you know, certain things fit into the category and certain things don't. You know, that's right. And that's fine. You know, I don't have a problem with that. I can't remember what movie it was. There was a movie I wanted to record with you a few years ago, and you said, no, it's not forgotten. I said, no, but it is forgotten. And you're like, no, it doesn't fit into the category. And then we pick something else, but which is fine.
Yeah. My general kind of thinking on that is, like, I look at Letterboxd. I see how many people have logged a movie on Letterboxd, and that is often kind of, you know, the way I arbitrarily look and go, okay, is this considered forgotten or isn't it? I don't know. You know,
ultimately, it's all down to the minimum number. What's the minimum number that needs to be on Letterboxd?
I tend to not go over any, you know, like if it's got like 10,000 views, that's, you know, usually gonna rule it out. But I mean, it's completely subjective. I could go various ways. I love it though when I, you know, like have someone propose a film and I pull it up and it's got like 500 views or something like that. And I'm like, oh, this is definitely game for the show. You know, this is, correct. This is,
yeah, okay. That makes sense. No, cause I, you know, there are cult films that are quote unquote forgotten, but so many people have seen them because they're cult films, you know, that type of thing.
Right. Right. And, and ultimately, you know, every film I bring up on the show, probably somebody out there might come back and say, that's not a forgotten film, you know, because it has a special place in their heart or whatever. Or sometimes it depends on regions. Like, you know, recently we did an episode on a British film called Ice Cold in Alex, which I had several of our podcasting friends come back to me and be kind of like, oh, well, this isn't forgotten. This is well known in our country. But all the U.S. people are like, I've never heard of this thing. So, you know, it kind of depends on where you are.
Yeah, that's true. I actually saw that a few years ago. I got to say, I didn't really like it very much. I found it really boring. But, okay, you know. You know, the whole idea is just to get a beer. You know, that's
and to brave the desert.
Yeah, but you brave the desert in order to get the beer. That's what it comes
exactly.
To. So okay, that's fair. That's fair. All right, let's actually start talking about Die Hard with a Vengeance. Why not?
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
So minute 81 begins with John not really being so sure, and ends with Zeus finding out that. Game over. So we ended things on Friday with John trying, you know, basically stealing Jerry's truck and turning around and, you know, sending Jerry on a mission, you know, go to Columbus Circle and find Inspector Cobb. And then he says to him, oh, who's the 23rd president? And he responded to him. And then this minute begins with John going, what? And he goes, Chester A. Arthur, 1881 to 1885. Nominated vice president in 1880. Did you know he was the collector of customs right here in New York? And John looks at him, like smirks with his typical John McClane / Bruce Willis smirk and goes, no, I didn't know that, Jerry. And he goes, take care of yourself. And starts driving off. Now, I know that you know, when we talked about this months ago, you said you wanted scenes with Jerry, you know, yes. And you get just a few seconds with him now, and later in the week we'll see him two more times. He doesn't open his mouth, but we get to see him. But why do you like Jerry so much?
So Jerry is just one of those wonderful, colorful side characters that I always kind of gravitate to in movies. But Jerry specifically, I've always been just enamored with his love of trivia. And part of that is because I love trivia. I like doing trivia games and such. My whole family likes doing trivia games. In fact, usually our dinner time activity is we sit around the dinner table eating, and our kind of conversation starter is that we work our way through Trivial Pursuit cards. We just have, you know, tons of editions of Trivial Pursuit, and we work our way through the questions, and it's a lot of fun for us. And especially the way that Jerry has this fascination with President Chester A. Arthur here reminds me of my son, because my son is the one we always look to for the questions that that have anything to do with the president. He always knows all the presidents in order, and you know, just various other little interesting facts about them. And so I actually just exposed my son to this chapter of the Die Hard series a few months back, because we just hadn't gotten there yet. You know, I'm always trying to show my kids various movies, and we watched Die Hard long ago, but not Die Hard 2 or Die Hard with a Vengeance. I was like, all right, we got to watch these. And so when we got to Die Hard with a Vengeance, I was like, Tim, Jerry reminds me of you because of his vast knowledge on these sort of things. So that's part of why I love Jerry.
Did he see a resemblance?
Oh yeah. You know, I
mean, or did he say, oh dad, come on, that's not me.
No. I think he loved it. He loved the comparison. So yeah, I just get a kick out of, Jerry being this, vast source of, trivial knowledge.
Okay. I love Jerry for the exact same reason. Cause I was that kid also who loved trivia. And I also, you know, when I was a kid, I knew all the presidents, you know, in order. I knew what years they were presidents. I knew tidbits about them. You know, mm-hmm. I could see myself, my younger self, you know, saying these exact words that Jerry says in this, you know, the beginning of this minute, you know, yeah. And it pretty much annoyed people that I would do that. You know, they're like, oh, Chester A. Arthur, 1881 to 1885. Did you know that he was, you know, he took over the presidency after Garfield was shot? And, you know, like all this stuff I knew. So I've always loved Jerry for that very reason also. And it's funny that you mentioned Trivial Pursuit, because basically what I wrote in my notes is that he reminds me of someone who loves to play either Trivial Pursuit or Jeopardy, right?
Yeah.
I we talked a little bit about this last week with my guest Richard, you know, about the fact that you know, if there were podcasts around that time, I could see Jerry having done some sort of podcast. You know,
oh, absolutely.
About what? I don't know. Whether it would be about the presidents, or whether it would be about mining, or about digging aqueduct tunnels or something like that. It could have been. There's so many different options. You know,
it might have just been a trivia podcast. I know my wife, that's how she fills her commute to work every day, is she downloads trivia podcasts and does those. And she's actually, you know, brought that to the rest of us. When we go on like a longer road trip, we're listening to those trivia podcasts. So
you want like screaming out answers?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So yeah, we need a podcast, a trivia podcast hosted by Jerry. That would be awesome.
That would really be very awesome. So what do you know about the game Trivial Pursuit? Do you know anything about the history of Trivial Pursuit?
I don't know the history of it. I mean, I remember when the first editions started to come out. I mean, I've got one just a few feet away from me that kind of, I don't know what shade of blue box it is, but it's that dark blue box. The Genus yes. edition is what they called
it. Of course.
And I want to say it would have been like in the late 70s, early 80s. I don't remember exactly when it would have come out. But, I mean, yeah, it's we just loved it ever since. But, yeah, I don't know the history of it.
Okay, so the game was originally created on December 15th, 1979, in Niagara-on-the-Lake, Ontario, by a guy named Chris Haney. who was a photo editor for like Montreal newspaper, the Gazette, and a friend of his, Scott Abbott, who was the sports editor for the Canadian Press. So the two of them were sitting in and they wanted to play Scrabble, and they found that there were a whole bunch of pieces that were missing. So they decided they would just create their own game. And they had two other friends who joined them to create this game, a guy named John Haney and another one, Ed Werner. And they eventually created the game. The game finished development in 1981. That's when that's when they released the Genesis edition that you and I are both familiar with. Basically, they were just sitting and writing questions all the time. They would go to the library and things like that. The rights moved from various different companies over the years. It was originally from Selchow and Ryder in 1982, and then it was bought up by Parker Brothers. And then because the and then in 2008, Hasbro bought the full rights for $80 million.
Oh,
By 1986, so we're talking 5 years after the game was started, they had sold more than 20 million units, with grossing more than $600 million in sales. And I mean, that's just, there are more than 100 million games that have been sold around the world. It's been translated into 17 different languages, and it was named to the Games Hall of Fame by Games Magazine in 1993. Are you familiar with the game with Games Magazine?
I've heard about it, but
Okay,
I
no,
can't
because
say I'm an avid reader.
no, I'm not an avid reader anymore either. But I remember when I was in high school, I had a subscription to Games Magazine. For me,
Oh,
that
okay.
was like that was heaven. I'm not a sports guy, so like for me, it was okay. I had Games Magazine and stuff like that. One of the problems that the Trivial Pursuit has had over the years is lawsuits. There were two big lawsuits against them. One of them was in October 1984. A man named Fred Worth, who's the author of the Trivia Encyclopedia, along with Super Trivia and Super Trivia 2, he filed a $300 million lawsuit against the distributors of Trivial Pursuit because he claimed that more than a quarter of the questions in the game had been taken directly from his books. And he said that they even copied typographical errors. And he had, when he created his books, he also put in deliberately placed misinformation. An example was that one of the questions of in Trivial Pursuit, and we'll see if you know the answer to this. What was Columbo's first name?
What was Columbus's first name?
Columbo.
Oh, Columbo. Oh,
Detective
gee.
Columbo.
Detective Columbo. I should know this, but I don't.
Okay, so
I want, or is it never said? I want to say maybe it's never
no,
said.
what they say here is that the answer Philip was fabricated in order to catch anyone who might try to violate copyright. So I think you're right. I think his name is never mentioned. But in Trivial Pursuit, they have that question and the answer is Philip, which they copied from there. So they actually admitted that Worth's books were among their sources, but the fact that they claimed that writing down facts was not protected by copyright.
Right,
And
exactly.
the judge actually agreed and ruled in favor of Trivial Pursuit. It was appealed. U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit upheld the ruling, and then he even went to the Supreme Court to try and get them to do it. But the Supreme Court decided that they weren't going to take it on.
Yeah.
Very, very cool, the whole idea.
I've actually experienced, that, a lot of these sets of questions do have the same questions in them. And I'm not just talking, about different versions of Trivial Pursuit, but we'll buy all kinds of different trivia card sets from different publishers and things like that. And we often find the same questions across these different versions of trivia cards and such. So it's, but I think, from what I hear there, that's the correct thing because, yeah, I mean, how can you copyright a fact?
Exactly. Okay, then in 1994, there was a second lawsuit. a man named David Wall from Nova Scotia launched a lawsuit against the creator, the game's creators, because he claims that in the fall of 1979, remember, they actually said that they came up with this idea on December 15th. So in the fall, so a few months beforehand, he and a friend were hitchhiking near Sydney, Nova Scotia, and they were picked up by Chris Haney, who's one of the four guys who did it. And he, this guy, David Wall, claims that he told Haney about his idea for this game in detail, including the shape of the markers. And Wall's mother ended up testifying in the court case that she found drawings that looked like plans for a Trivial Pursuit-like game, but the drawings had been destroyed. And a friend of Wall's, who was apparently hitchhiking, never testified. And Haney claims that he actually never met Wall. So there's been a lot of legal issues over Trivial Pursuit over the years. You know, whether people claim whether it should be something that needs to be decided by a judge or a jury. It took till 2007. So think about it. He brought this case in 1994. So it took 13 years for the Nova Scotia Supreme Court to finally rule against the Wall that he didn't really have any proof.
It's, you know, the whole thing they say about Swift in the legal process is not always true.
Apparently not. I mean, this is the Canadian legal system, so I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No idea. So, yeah, so Jerry reminds me of Trivial Pursuit, and, you know, I'm glad that I've now taught you a little bit about Trivial Pursuit. Now you can go use that trivia with your family at dinner
Absolutely.
Tonight.
Absolutely.
You can say, guess what?
Trivial Pursuit
I now
trivia.
Know. There you go. Why not? Now, does your son-in-law fit into this this scheme of things also?
The scheme of things as far as what?
No, does he sit at the table and
my son-in-law
and join in the trivia with you, or does he feel like an outsider because this is, you know, a Lebanon thing?
He does. There are times where I think he's maybe not as well versed in some of the useless trivia, but he's good at coming up with just random responses when he doesn't know the answer. You know.
Okay.
He just, you know, he'll come up with, you know, things that just, you know, have absolutely nothing to do with the question, just to be funny. So that's fun.
Okay. All right. Did your daughter make him take a trivia test before getting married?
No.
So there's no Steve Guttenberg diner situation here.
All I did was I asked the traditional question that my father-in-law asked to me and asked to my wife's sister's husband when we were announcing our plans to marry his daughters was his question is always, do you like peanut butter? So when my son-in-law asked me about the okay for marrying my daughter, I said, well, do you like peanut butter?
And okay, you got me curious. Why is that a factor?
It's just because my father-in-law really likes peanut butter, so that's always been his thing, and we traditionally will often buy him various peanut butter you know, flavored or you know, strange delicacies that involve peanut butter. You know, like if we're out traveling somewhere and one time we ran across peanut butter flavored soda, so we had to buy a bottle of that and bring it home for him.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I guess I can't be part of your family because I don't like peanut butter. Oh, well. What can you do? All right. So at this point, you know, John basically just, you know, leaves Jerry and starts driving away. But it's very strange. John asks him for this information. He gives him the information, but then he doesn't say to him at this point, okay, now that you have this information, do something with it. Because, you know, his question on Friday was, you know, find out who the 23rd president is and tell Cobb.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't respond. He doesn't at this point say to him, okay, tell Cobb, Chester A. Arthur, you know, that type of thing.
Well, Jerry connected the dots. He's a smart guy.
Well, he's smart. He's trivia smart. But is he smart enough to realize that, okay, maybe.
Apparently he is, because
Yeah, well, we'll get there. We'll get there because there are more questions later in the week about that one.
Yeah.
And at this point, I one last thing I want to say about Jerry. I love his arm movements when he's talking.
Well, it's a New York thing, isn't it? You know, they're the folks from New York are always very expressive with their arms when they speak.
Okay, good. No, because he goes, when he was a collector in customs right here in New York, he like points to the ground, you know, as he's doing that. And it's just great.
Which I'm surprised you haven't laid on us any trivia about the collector of customs in New York.
No, sorry. Don't have any trivia for you. Do you have trivia for me on it?
I looked it up just because I was curious, you know, what exactly is this and does this still exist? And it doesn't still exist, but if you go on Wikipedia, they've got a listing for this and where you can actually see pictures of most of the people that were collector of customs in New York. But yeah, they got rid of the position in 1966. So,
Okay. And so it wasn't Chester Arthur who got rid of the idea of being a customs collector.
No, he could have. He would have been like, you know, nobody's going to do this job as good as I. So, you know, we're just going to get rid of it.
Well, considering the fact that it took them 80 years to get rid of it, I don't think so. Especially since we talked about on Friday that Chester A. Arthur was the president who lived the second shortest amount of time after leaving office.
Talking about odd trivia things, whenever I hear the name Chester A. Arthur, I always think about when he's mentioned in a Simpsons episode, because the kids are doing some kind of production about the presidents. In fact, there's a song where they do about the mediocre presidents. We are the mediocre presidents. And then Bart comes out.
I've actually heard that. Okay.
Yeah. It's John Wilkes Booth that he's like shooting one of those like ping pong ball guns. And he starts opening fire on the other presidents. And he goes, "You're next, Chester A. Arthur."
Oh, that's great. That's great. All right, so we're done with Jerry for now. Then the scene changes and we see Zeus in Yankee Stadium, which goes back to my question that I've asked numerous times: how do you, even if you have a ticket, how do you get into Yankee Stadium this early?
That's the thing.
Let's say there's a game at night.
This is why this moment, I mean, it's funny because I asked for Jerry. I got some Jerry. I'm very happy about that. But then I get this moment where I'm like, this is always the part of the film where I'm like, it doesn't work that way. You can't just walk into an MLB park, even back in 1990, whatever. You can't just do that.
No, but he did have a ticket.
Did he have a ticket?
Yes, they had two tickets, which raises the question. It raises the question of why were there two tickets, but whatever, because they didn't know that Zeus was going to be part of this whole thing when they set up the scheme. But okay, whatever. We'll get more to those type of questions later this week also with the school, but whatever.
You're right then. It would be very early, even with a ticket, to get in if it was a night game. I suppose it could be a daytime game, and maybe my brain's more wired that way because
this is like 1:30. This is already 1:30. So a day game isn't a day game at 1:35?
It depends on when I was growing up in the Chicago area, traditionally Cubs games were at 1:15, I think it was 1:20, something like that.
Okay.
And because, you know, that's before the lights. That's the only time that they played them at Wrigley Field.
Right.
But then kind of around, I think, 1984, 85 or so, they started doing a late or a mid-afternoon start. There was like one game a week that would start at 3:00. And, I think they were trying to maybe get, you know, a bit more people that were maybe like, okay, I'm going to take off work an hour or so early and go over to Wrigley Field and catch the game. I don't know if they ever did anything like that at Yankee Stadium. Well, you know, maybe this was a 3:00 in the afternoon game. Who knows?
I don't know. That's just, I don't know. It's a little strange. You know, it doesn't make that much sense to me that the question is whether the Yankees even were in town.
Well, yeah. Well, and I mean, not only does, you know, is Zeus able to get in there, but so are the bad guys, one of whom has, you know, taken up position in a press box, I'm guessing. It's like, you know, why aren't there reporters
with a hunting rifle?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, again, granted, back then, we didn't have to go through metal detectors to get into an MLB park like we do today. But still, this whole scene is a bit of a stretch.
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, one of the things also is that we've already proven that this takes place in late September, early October, 1994.
Okay.
Okay. Do you remember what happened in 1994 with baseball?
Is that the earthquake year?
No.
Okay.
It was.
Oh, there was a strike. There was a strike. There okay. A, yes.
That's right.
Oh no, I do remember that now very clearly.
The season ended August 11th.
Yes, yes. So I remember that was my first full year, my first full summer in Colorado, and of course the Colorado Rockies.
And the Rockies were already there. They started in '93, didn't they?
Right. This was their second season, and it got cut off early. Yeah.
No, so I decided to at least look for 1995. You know, when the games pretty much started in September. Okay, now every one of the games that takes place, and it doesn't matter whether it's in Yankee Stadium or not. Okay, every one of their games, they had 27 games in September of 1995. Again, this doesn't take place in September 1995, but just to get an idea, all of the earliest game was at 1:05. And then you had one at 1:36, you had one at 2:07, and then all the others are after 7 p.m. So you know that obviously doesn't make sense. No. But if
this, of course, in the movie is the original Yankee Stadium too. Is this one doesn't exist anymore?
That is correct. This is the house that Ruth built.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So Zeus is there. He walks all the way down to the dugout. And then he looks down at the chairs and he sees a little game sitting on the chair. I couldn't remember the name of the game, and I wasn't able to find any information about it. But I do recall playing games like this as a kid, where you have, you know, this little square box with little balls in them, and you have to, like, you know, get all the balls in the various holes.
Mm-hmm.
So. Again, I don't know exactly what it's called. Zeus then starts looking around, trying to figure out what he's doing there. He moves a little closer, starts looking around, is very curious what's going on here. And then he cautiously picks up the game. And as he's picking it up, then we get to see the two friends that you mentioned before. So we have two of Simon's henchmen that are, I guess, in the press box or something like that. One of them is sitting there with a walkie-talkie, and the other one has a window slightly open, and he has a sniper rifle with a scope on it. So these two actors, okay, the guy who's shooting, you know, inside, so his name is Phil Theis, Theis. He only has 5 IMDb credits, but he was actually a professional wrestler.
Oh.
During the 90s, his two names that he went by were Mondo Clean and Damian Demento.
Those are great. Yeah, well, you know, there's a great history of wrestlers becoming actors, you know. I mean,
yes, there are.
All the way from Dwayne Johnson, Dave Bautista, even down to Tor Johnson in the Ed Wood films. So
that's right. That's right. The first one, his name is Eric, and the second one, his name is Misha, and his real name is also Misha. It's Misha Hausman. He was born in 1941 and passed away in 2021 at the age of 79. He only has 27 IMDb credits as an actor, but he is also an assistant director for John McTiernan. He was the assistant director in three of McTiernan's films: Thomas Crown Affair, Basic, and Rollerball. He had small parts in 5 of his movies: Die Hard with a Vengeance, Thomas Crown Affair, 13th Warrior, Basic, and Rollerball. And in this movie, in addition to being this terrorist, he is also the what's known as the aerial coordinator.
Mm, I was going to say, so sounds like he's probably a stunt guy. Yeah.
And then the two of them start having a little bit of a conversation. He goes, now? And he goes, no, there's only one of them. You know, they say a few other things in German, but there's no subtitles, not on the movie itself or on the transcript from the from subtitles. And then we see Zeus carefully looking under this little game to see what it says, and then he's very confused, and he sees that there's a taped on the back. It says "Game Over." And then he looks around trying to figure out what it is that's going on. He's very confused at this point.
You got to hand it to Simon, though, that he used one of those, printable label makers to put "Game Over" on the bottom of it. He's a higher class and a criminal. He doesn't just, grab a Sharpie and write "Game Over" on a piece of masking tape. He uses a label maker.
There you go. Hey, come on. We all use label makers in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, of course.
I know I did.
we all had lofty goals of using that thing to, accurately label all of our VHS tapes that, with the movies we'd recorded off of HBO and such. And, we did good for a few weeks. And then eventually we just stopped using the label maker and it got dusty in a drawer somewhere.
Yes, it's true. It's a little bit of an issue. But yeah. The things we thought would be much more useful, 35, 40 years ago. Mm. Oh, well. Okay. So that's all we have for that's all I have for this minute. Do you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
No, I think we got it.
Okay. So the script, there's absolutely nothing that happens in this minute that's in the script because we finished with the part with Jerry, because Jerry in the script, Jerry doesn't even drive into the tunnel with him. John leaves Jerry outside, and Zeus doesn't go to Yankee Stadium. He ends up going to New York Public Library, and he was given, he had to find a book that was there, which he found last week. So there's nothing that happens here on this one. So every Monday we have a segment called McTiernan Monday, where my guests will give their top five John McTiernan films. So you only have 11 to choose from. So
yeah.
What have you got for us, Todd? Start with your number five and work your way up.
It's kind of tough because there may be films that are actually better than my number five, but I went is most memorable to me. And I think this is not as bad as people made it out to be at the time, but I'll go with Last Action Hero as number five. I think it's a perfectly fun movie. Four is The Hunt for Red October. Three is Die Hard with a Vengeance. Two is Predator. And one is the original Die Hard.
All right. That's a very solid list. Thank you very much for that. All right. So, Todd, would you like to tell people where they can find Todd Liebenow?
Oh, of course. Well, I have a podcast called The Forgotten Filmcast, which you can find in all the places where you get your podcasts. I also have a blog called Forgotten Films, which is at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. And you can follow me on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter, at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So, Todd, feel like coming back again tomorrow?
Absolutely.
All right. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Johnny comes marching home again. Hoorah, hoorah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then. Hoorah, hoorah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.